session number 177747, reel 11.
It's talking about spit and polish and repainting and smarting up guns in preparation for a procession. I see that this was in fact on the 4th of June 43, and it was a parade in Ballymena, Ballymena being a much bigger place than Ballymoney and probably the capital of County Antrim. We had had great preparations and there were heaps of people there. Regrettably, my truck broke down in the first 50 yards and had to be towed away. The thing went down quite well. It was a PR exercise, and one realises, of course, in retrospect, how this must have been a symbolic thing in Northern Ireland, to one side or the other side. At that time, we were too naive to realise that there were two sides, as clearly as we now know, or as there seemed to be. The middle ground was, which ought to be more populous now, really was at that time more of a middle ground, and people were not so het up about, certainly not about the appearance of British soldiery, which was taken for granted. So we had a successful procession, and it ended, of course, as things tend to do in Ireland, with rain, a lot of rain. And we eventually got back to Loch Gael.
How far from Ballymoney was Loch Gael?
I think, you see, as I've said, I can't even locate it on a map unless I go to the trouble of buying a one-inch map, which I haven't done. But it can't have been more than 10 to 12 miles.
Well, if you were cycling it...
Yes, that's true, cycling it. But, I mean, also cycling was for general exercise round about rather than just going to Ballymoney. Ballymoney tended to be a bit of a truck ride. I would have said 10 miles. It was far enough to make walking too far for any social event. You needed petrol or foot power. There was time to contemplate there when you were not actively socially involved, walking around, and I went and had a look at a disused, broken-down church, and then we did gun drill. I went and had a talk with the Catholic priest to whose church I had led church parades, found he was an interesting old boy called Father Hayes. More and more gun drill. Tommy Thompson was back from his first fortnight of sick leave, he wasn't back for long before he went for good, but he was not feeling too well, and he let me take the troop for gun drill. And then I stayed in the hut and read history and philosophy and dealt with some correspondence. The next day, Tommy Thompson, the captain, was carted off to hospital with pneumonia. This is a damp and unhealthy place. And I.
Did you have any other casualties or sickness?
We did,
cases?
Yes. Mm. He wasn't the only one to be taken off. I remember a fellow captain was a fellow of his. Two of my captains were taken off ill. But I noticed here, and this is just a sort of a digression, that it's pointing up the differences between officers from different backgrounds, that Tommy Thompson, as a regular officer in his mid-20s, Scottish, and delighted with his rate of saving. On his birthday recently, he let it slip that his mother's birthday present would take his savings to over £2,000, Now, at this time, I had £18, and he couldn't possibly have known this. It was taken for granted by people from his sort of background that everybody had a bit of money around, and it would have seemed inconceivable to them that some of us just didn't have any.
Did you find then that, on the whole, your day-to-day expenditure took most of your pay?
I wouldn't have said that, no. I think I saved more or less steadily throughout commissioned service in the army. My pay would be, at a guess, about £4 a week, and you drew on it when you needed it. You tended to have it paid into your Cox and King's account. Cox and King's, the subsidiary of Lloyd's,
did the
banking for the gunners, and it was paid in there, and you tended to draw out some when you needed it. Mess bills were sometimes higher than you had expected, but they ought not to be too high, because this itself was tended to be frowned upon, and of course treating was out.
Treating was out?
Yes, you shouldn't treat in the mess.
What did you normally drink?
I didn't normally drink much at all, but there was no wine available. I mean, wine was out. Wine didn't enter the popular consciousness of this country till after the war. We brought the consciousness back from places like Italy. So it was either, one is talking about either beer or spirits, or gin. Gin was well known. By spirits, I mean whiskey or gin. It wasn't, on the whole, rum or brandy. It was whiskey or gin.
Being in Northern Ireland,
it was Bushmills.
Bushmills Distillery.
It was Bushmills or John Jameson, yes. And we were not far from Bushmills, so it was theirs on the whole. That's right. Didn't drink a lot anyway. I mean, I was not a drinking sort of chap until later. That's why I managed to make myself ill by going out and having three or four whiskies.
Were there positive attempts made to control drinking by the soldiers?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer. You could hardly stop them going into the pubs when you were in a town. I don't think there was drink available in their messes. The sergeant's mess would have some drink available, but not the gunner's mess. The NCO, the bombardiers, I'm not sure whether they had a separate mess. No, they didn't have a separate mess. I had not had a separate mess when I was Lance Bombardier. I'm not very genned up on this, because I was not interested in drink at that stage in my life.
It's often alleged that when troops are fed up or bored, as they might well have been at Port Geal, then they tend to drink.
Yes.
And that this can lead to disciplinary difficulties, particularly people coming back late, being disorderly on occasion.
Yes. Well, I think this would be... Lough Geal had an automatic control of that, in the sense that they would only... There were no pubs there, you see. They'd be coming back from Ballymoney, having gone on the official transport, and they'd be coming back on it. That would be the setup. And, of course, if anybody missed the official transport, then they'd be on a charge. Furthermore, they'd have to walk about 10 miles back. But I don't remember riotous behaviour or drunkenness featuring very large at all. My memory is so poor about these things, I feel almost guilty, but it seemed to be a period in which little happened, either in terms of discipline or anything other exciting things. Just a lot of cycling, a lot of gun drill, a lot of fresh air, and we went on, exercise contact on the 15th of June, spending the first night in a farm. I'm now acting as the survey officer at RHQ. I'd forgotten that totally, survey officer at RHQ, and relieving the adjutant. Presumably I was enlisted for that job because I had done geography at A-level with bits of my very elementary surveying thrown in, and because I was interested in it.
It would be mainly map work, wouldn't it?
It would be, yes. Yes, that's right.
So would this involve spotting likely routes into an operational area, likely positions for yourself and enemy forces, or would it involve some other
activities? I suppose that's what it would be. I'm just trying to think whether it would have involved any map making, but there's really no need for that, because we have, all the maps were available. What it would be, I mean, the main function of a regimental survey is to help to arrange the locations for the batteries, and possibly even the troops within the batteries, the correct or a sensible distribution of firepower at its origins.
A matter of deployment.
Deployment, right? Yes, that's right. In terms of range to the likely enemy, sensible communicable spread of guns, and of course the possible locations for suitable observation posts, OPs.
How many little subunits would you have in a battery? Presumably you would have the two troops, and they would possibly be broken down into sections. Yeah. Then you would have the battery headquarters, which would be a separate entity.
That's right. Small.
And then you would have possibly observation posts, possibly more than one OP.
You'd have two OPs, one for each troop.
Yes.
Usually. I mean, you could do with one if you were doing the same job as a battery, but invariably the troop commander's job was to be the OP.
Presumably, the preferred means of communication would be line.
That's
from
right.
the point of view of security. That's right. So presumably the...
Not only security in those days, reliability.
So presumably you'd also have to take into account the extent to which you could lay a telephone network within a given time when considering how to actually deploy all your elements.
Exactly. It was one of the many factors. What I can't remember, and I ought to, is the extent to which the Royal Corps of Signals were involved. Headquarters, regimental headquarters, had a signals officer who was a member of the Royal Corps of Signals on permanent attachment. Just as you had a doctor from the Royal Army Medical Corps, you would have a signals officer, SIGS, who was from the signals. He lived with us and was one of us, except his cap badge was different. And he was responsible for, ultimately, for the signalling within the regiment, in the directing sense. I mean, how to get the stuff to... it was important to get the stuff to RHQ from the brigade and from the infantry, both the gunner brigade headquarters, the CRA, Command of Royal Artillery, and to your infantry brigade you're associated with. Below RHQ level, the signalling was a responsibility of the regiment, helped by this experienced signals officer.
Do you recall how many signallers you would have in your battery signals office? What scale of
manning? I can't remember, but I would have thought about three, something like that. Of course, I had had my original training as a gunner signaller, and so I knew a little bit about how to do this, this work. But I think it wouldn't be more than two or three, I would guess.
Because presumably you'd have to have the capability amongst your... These would be regimental signals, wouldn't they, rather than royal signals?
Yes, they're
not royal
signals.
To deal with both forms of communication, both systems, and also deal with runners or dispatch riders, deal with messages in
various
kinds.
Oh, yes, you had a Don R at battery, of course, who would have other duties as well. I can't remember whether this was ever doubled up with, for example, being a batman or whatever. Perhaps not.
Presumably he'd be more useful for rear link than for...
Yes. Yes, although Don R's did come to the troops from time to time. People had to be reasonably flexible, particularly until lines were established. I mean, it took a little time to lay lines. And the one was dependent on the radio until then. But if something urgent happened and something secure, then you would find a Don R turning up on his motorbike and handing over a message from battery, or more particularly from RHQ to battery.
Do you remember anything else about Operation Contact the scenario or the course of the phases of the exercise?
Well, let's see what happened. We moved off on exercise contact in the afternoon to a farm north of Dervock, which I've never heard of, D-E-R-V-O-C-K. I was acting as survey officer and also relieving the adjutant. The next morning, 16th of May, June, we were up at 4:30, and the regiment moved off to a rendezvous of my choosing. It was the first time I'd had to choose an RV for the regiment. And I found that my driver, this is just a bit of sociology, was a New Zealander who was an art teacher in civil life.
He was a long way from home.
He was a long way from home. But we did have, I found an Australian as my first troop commander in Italy and so on. The regiment had to turn round in the road to go to a different place, which was quite a feat to turn a regiment round in the road with the guns. And we went to a position near Cloch, C-L-O-G-H, which is a dirty farm. Eventually moved to our final farm near Broshen. I think it was partly an exercise in getting around this, not a shooting exercise.
That reading and movement.
Yeah, that's right.
It sounds as though you might have been practicing that particular evolution called the advance to contact.
Could be. I mean, the term you use doesn't mean anything to me any longer, but sounds like it. And having to be flexible because you didn't know quite where the enemy was, and you found out, and then he changed. We had to, the next day, we moved to our final farm. Then we had the second in command and I carried out a recce. I surveyed and messed about in a PU, personal utility truck, they were little Hillman 1500 weights. We had waiting, and then we conducted a barrage. You mentioned a barrage. This was a barrage, presumably without ammunition.
Be a paper barrage,
though. A paper, that's right. Fine evening and night, but no sleep. Whole morning and afternoon the next day, waiting to move. Eventually we got the order to go back home, and I headed the entire column back, and we were very tired. And then the next day we were once again getting guns ready for firing camp. I had an air flight booking came through for leave 3 weeks ahead, so things were beginning to look clearer as to my future. But that was some time ahead, or was it? Yes. My leave was arranged for a month ahead, the 5th to the 15th of July, but on the very next day I was sent for by the colonel and told I was posted. This is the way things happen in the army. Having had a week's leave arranged for 3 weeks ahead, the very next day I was told I was posted, and it was literally posted that day.
You had to pack up and move.
Pack up, feverish rush, farewells, pack. The regiment is off to shoot in the Sperrin Mountains, but not me. Jack Lewis, with whom I had gone from Octu to Northern Ireland, and I, we were posted together, and we had to go off to Watford. And we spent the night again in the Belgravia Hotel in Belfast. And Monday, up at 9, had a haircut, sent a telegram home to my parents. Have lobster for lunch and read Omar Khayyam. It must have been a splendid day instead of going to the Sperrin Mountains. Catch the 4:55 train to Larne and have a good crossing to Stranraer. I think that crossing has just been closed, hasn't it? Stranraer to Larne. It's not economic.
It's into Scotland. Yes.
That's right. Near somewhere near Glasgow.
Had the colonel told you anything about where you were going or why?
Well, we're going to, I was obviously going to be got ready for war, and Watford was the sort of holding unit for people. It was not a normal RA regiment or anything of that kind. It was
a depot.
Sort of depot, yes, exactly. Stranraer, home to North Lincolnshire, 2 p.m. See the effects of bombing in the town. And the next morning, 9 o'clock train to King's Cross. Have lunch with Jack Lewis at the Strand Palace. Then to Watford. and find myself in the RHQ billets and mess at Apsley Lodge in the Cassiebury Park area of Watford. Meet colleagues in the same position whom I had known at Octu, four or five of them. Hear that it's an easy time here, coffee, cafes, lovely posting, posh residential area with excellent billets. Posted to C Battery, attend a lecture on deployment, which I found irrelevant, and I put in for some leave. Had a skeleton drill order in Cassiebury Park, Watford. I found from my background in Lincolnshire and rather seedy towns in some cases and areas, I found Watford a beautifully built town as it was then. Had a major we thought was rather a silly man, but we spent a lot of time on motorbikes, had a motorcycle test, good fun to be going through doing rough riding over obstacles in Cassiebury Park, and I passed the test and went off to London, Westminster, the city, went into St Paul's. I was not familiar with London, of course. I had been there, but only about twice in my life. Went to the Windmill Theatre, not particularly good. Corner houses, Lyons Corner houses disappeared some years ago, I think.
I mean, when you got to Watford, did they have any information for you then about what you were going to be doing once you moved on?
No, they didn't at this stage. We were just there, and we expected to be there anything from 2 or 3 weeks upwards, but not for very long. Got leave, week's leave, and I had to write to the Railway Air Service to cancel the leave which had been booked for me in Northern Ireland. Found a shock in my pay docket from Cox and Kings. They had deducted income tax. I had to pay income tax for the first time. I wrote a firm letter denying my liability. What happened, I don't know.
Do you remember what the grounds were?
I have no idea at all. This, of course, was, I think, before the time of Pay As You Earn. I'm just wondering whether it was a bill for income tax or whether, for some reason, it was deducted at source in the army before the PAYE. Perhaps PAYE had started. I can't remember.
It would certainly be more of a shock to you, one imagines, if they had suddenly taken a whole year's pay.
Oh, yes.
A whole year's worth of tax out of your pay.
Well, yes, it would have busted. Yes,
I can't
remember
when they started. They abandoned taking income tax as a sort of annual basis and made it...
PAYE.
PAYE.
Yes, I can't remember. It may have been that it was an early wartime innovation. Anyway, I thought it was unfair or wrong for some reason. I've noted the Germans were opening their summer offensive in Russia. This is July 43. This is all talk whilst on leave. And I went back on the 7th of July to Watford. That was that. I had a curious little interlude. I had got quite friendly in the most innocent way with a nice girl in Belfast who was a WAF, and after this posting I wrote her a letter just to make contact, and to my surprise, when I got back to Watford from this leave, I found a letter for me from this girl's father, who'd opened my letter to her, which I think these days would be vastly resented by any young person, indeed it was then, hoping that my intentions were strictly honourable. You sound nice enough, and I hope your intentions are strictly honourable, etc. So that was something to tear up.
Did you not reply to it?
I didn't reply to it, no. I would have done, I think, these days.
Did you ever get a reply from the girl?
No, she never got the letter, I don't think. I think this was an interception. Parents were different in those days. They were brave. just an amusing lady. She was a nice girl. I'd like to know more. Yes. We were at this holding depot in Watford in from early July 43, and I've noted we did all kinds of things. We did a lot of motorcycling because Cassiebury Park was big enough to allow it, and it was rather fun if you had been trained, as I had in the Gunners, to ride a motorbike. We used to compete against each other, getting over obstacles without falling off, this sort of thing. And I see that I had a day of motorcycling on the 9th of July, acting as battery signal sergeant, presumably supervising line laying. We did the usual things of pretending to be young officers, inspecting a few billets, I notice. We went into London whenever we could because, well, a great place, and the it was between German crescendos of bombing in 1940, and the flying bombs hadn't yet started. So it was splendid to be able to get into London. It's couldn't have been more different from Loch Giel. Now, how long? Oh, I got a mess bill sent on to me from 171 Battery in Northern Ireland. 171 was the regiment, I think, not the battery, yes. And I had a letter from home telling me about a blitz firebombs on Grimsby, which was my nearest hometown. And today I act as a battery signals officer, then all day on motorbikes. And we had to cook our own dinner. This was another piece of training, hellish meal, I put. Next day, officially in charge of the signalers in the regiment and given an entirely free hand as to what they should do. And again, more signalling goes on during that week. Take a Canadian pilot officer for a trip round London. This was not a casual social thing. It was something I was detailed to do, and I've totally forgotten what it was about. But it was... they were trying to find ways of keeping us busy. Plenty of leisure. It was a delightful time. And then... I must have had some notice about postings or something. At the end of July, make plans for my signalers, order trucks, rations, etc. Valuable experience. Yes, this was getting ready for a big scheme on the following day.
This was organised from the transit depot.
This was organised from the transit depot to keep us busy. It doesn't seem to have amounted to very much other than the planning. We were on a village common doing various drills, I don't specify what, then lecturing signallers and browsing in hot sun. Major Gedge sees me about the signals work and says he's very pleased with what I'm doing, so that's a slight feather. And then the brigadier came the next day, and I'm let off all orderly officer duties and made command post officer for the day. CPO, that's a battery level thing.
Were the soldiers in Watford also just passing through on their way to...
Yes, it was a depot. There were hardly any soldiers there. I mean, most of the soldiers who were there were of the other gender. I mean, they were RACs, whatever they call, ATS, looking after the billets. There weren't many soldiers.
Have you any notion of how many officers there were at Watford at the time?
No, I have no idea. I would have thought it could be numbered in 100 to 200. That would be my guess. Just for make an economical size for messing and generally manning the place. Another signal scheme in the park. And then... went to the pictures to with the intention of... No, Government, it was a club, with the intention of writing some letters, but I was interrupted by a colleague called Jakes with the news that we are posted to a depot and have been given 14 days leave, a very thrilling news. Go to a fair in Cassibridge Park, and then the next day we packed and went to the MO, seen by the MO, the adjutant, quartermaster, etc., and get a lot of documents. Great trouble getting kit together. Have to break a date with an old college friend. Hear that Mussolini resigned today, 25th of July, 43. Sat up and talked nearly all night. Home on leave. The railway lost my kit on the way home. Great. August bank holiday 1943 at home. No good, my kit bag is definitely...